Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 23rd day of July, 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. So, every day in the United States, millions of expectant mothers take a prenatal vitamin, and they do that on the advice of their doctor. The counsel typically comes with physical health in mind: folic acid to help avoid fetal spinal cord problems, iodine to spur healthy brain development, calcium to be bound like molecular Legos into diminutive baby bones. But what about a child's future mental health? Questions about whether ADHD might arise a few years down the road, or whether schizophrenia could crop up in young adulthood, tend to be overshadowed by more immediate parental anxieties. As a friend with a newborn daughter recently fretted over lunch, "I'm just trying not to drop her." I've just been reading from an article from National Public Radio that was written by Brett Stedka, and it was called "Can Mental Illness Be Prevented in the Womb?" That article goes on to say, "Yet, much as pediatricians administer childhood vaccines to guard against future infections, some psychiatrists now are thinking about how to shift their treatment, their treatment-centric discipline, toward one that also deals in early prevention." Well, that sounds promising. To talk not just about the idea discussed in that article that was published almost 6 years ago, but to learn where we are now and how close we might be to that reality, it is my pleasure to welcome to the program a University of Colorado physician and researcher who is at the center of this effort to discuss the remarkable progress being made to prevent mental illness before birth. Dr. Robert Friedman, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you start your research into preventing mental illness before birth, and where are you now?
We were interested, like many research labs, in finding genes that cause schizophrenia, ADHD, autism, and other mental illnesses, and directing new treatments towards them. And while I was doing that, I had an aha moment one morning in the shower. I have to say it was about 15 years ago, before the drought, that we had it all wrong. We were trying to treat illnesses in adults that had their roots very early in brain development, before these adults had even been born, when they were still babies in the womb. And that's where we needed to direct our treatment efforts. And so I immediately came in and announced to our entire laboratory that we were going to retool and start studying how babies develop, and that's where we were going to intervene. We wanted to make sure that we were not simply trying to remediate something that had happened years ago. We wanted to get in there before the ball game was over.
Robert Friedman is a medical doctor, and he is the chairman of the Department of Pharmacology and a professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He's a graduate of Harvard Medical School and was trained at the National Institutes of Health and the University of Chicago. Dr. Friedman has been widely recognized and awarded for his extensive and deep research and investigation into multiple medical issues, ranging from the molecular genetics of schizophrenia to the effects of gestational COVID-19 infection on fetal brain development, to prenatal prevention of psychiatric illness and childhood development across our population. So, your research centers around choline. What is choline?
Choline is a natural substance. It's half a fat, half an amino acid, and as a transitory molecule, it forms this layer that's between our cells and the outside. And so our bodies are full of choline, mostly in a form called phosphatidylcholine. which is a kind of fat, also called lecithin. It's something that's naturally found in meats, many vegetables, and eggs, and it's particularly high in liver because liver is so full of cells. So it's a natural ingredient, and it's one that we found has a very special role in development.
So what I saw from your excellent website, which is called prenataldoctoradvice.com, prenataldoctoradvice.com, is that you that choline is three things. It's essential to brain development in a fetus, and it's deficient in pregnant women, and then three, let me see if I can get to this. If you couple those facts with animal and human research that you have done, it shows that choline in amniotic fluid activates a specific receptor in the developing fetal brain. Put that together for me.
Sure. So what we were researching was how the brain filters information, a very fundamental problem that many people with mental illness, particularly schizophrenia, but also autism and ADHD have, is that they have trouble distinguishing what's important from what's not important. So, for example, while we're talking and someone's listening to this, there may be noises in the background. Most of us are able to tune out those noises and focus in on what we're interested in focusing in on. People with schizophrenia have a remarkable ability to tune in to everything, and hence they can't really concentrate on anything. As one of my patients said, it has to be here, I have to be there, I have to be everywhere, I can't focus on anything. So things like refrigerators cycling on and off, air conditioners, those drive people with schizophrenia crazy because they think that somehow these are machines that are plotting against them. When the TV's on and they may hear someone speaking in the background, they think that person is speaking to them. We understood this to be a very fundamental deficit and something that we eventually could study electrophysiologically. We could actually detect in their brain waves when they were paying attention to things that other people could filter out. We began to dissect that, and we discovered that one particular receptor was very important. It's a protein on a nerve cell that receives a chemical called acetylcholine, and it also can respond to nicotine. And it explained to us why people with schizophrenia are such heavy smokers, because when they smoke, they can actually activate the receptor that is not working so well a little better because of the nicotine. Now, we don't recommend that people smoke because it's also carcinogenic and it's hard on their hearts, but it does help them transiently focus. All of this was a mystery. We didn't understand what gene was making this protein. And so I did what every right-thinking pharmacologist would do. I immediately got on an airplane and I flew to Paris. Why Paris? Because that's where the world's expert on these kinds of cholinergic nicotinic receptors lived, at the Institut Louis Pasteur. And I said, "Professor, what do you think?" He said, "I think it's an artifact." In other words, something that you've done that's a mistake. And I said, "Well, what do I do now?" He said, "You get back on the plane, you get back in your laboratory and try to find your mistake." So disappointed, I got back on the plane, flew back to Denver. We continued working in the lab, and in 6 months he called me up and he said, "It wasn't an artifact. We've discovered the gene that you've been working on."
Wow.
And so he and I, of course, became fast friends. And we began to make medications to try to improve how that gene worked. And we also spent a lot of time in the molecular biology of the gene trying to figure out just what went wrong in schizophrenia. And to do that, my colleague, Dr. Sherry Leonard, obtained a set of molecules that was made from a fetus that had died and the tissues had been saved. And I said, why did you use those tissues? She said, oh, everyone knows that fetal brain expresses genes much more robustly than in adults. And I thought about that for a moment, and I realized, of course, she was right. There are two miracles about our brain. The first miracle is that it works at all. It's the world's most powerful computer. We don't have the foggiest idea of how it works. If we really understood how it works, it wouldn't be a very good brain. So we have a brain that we can't understand. But even a bigger miracle is that entire brain forms from one single skin cell that about the second week in development decides that it's going to be a brain instead of a piece of our skin. And how it does that with nothing else than the program of its genes to tell it how to form the entire human brain is very much a miracle.
And is this different in humans than it is in other mammals? And is it different in mammals than it is in other living creatures?
It's just simply more complex in humans.
Okay.
And in humans, our brains are pretty well formed by birth. In other mammals, they tend to be born in a much more embryonic form, but it differs among species. And but what's important for us is we have the most complex brain, and all that complexity is formed before birth. The baby, over its next 20 years, will strengthen different parts of it, just like it strengthens its muscles and its bones to learn to walk and then to throw and then to play football. Our brains get strengthened so we can learn to talk, we can learn to think, and eventually we can learn to make good judgments. But those are strengthenings of things that have already happened before birth. And embedded in what's happened before birth are also the first roots of mental illness. And so as the baby develops and good things like thinking and judgment appear, also sometimes symptoms of mental illness begin to appear that were put there long before the baby was born. And so when people say you were born with a miswired brain, they're correct. And we wanted to see if we could adjust that wiring while it was still being formed before birth.
Do you believe that all mental illness occurs in utero?
No. I think the mental illness, there are all kinds of different stages where mental illness occurs. For example, one of my patients had relatives with mental illness, and so she was always a shy, withdrawn person. But she was a wonderful pianist, and her father, who was a music teacher, taught her to play the piano. And she got better and better at it. She was shy, and so she found herself a job on a cruise ship where she didn't have to interact with a lot of people. But one day, one of her fellow entertainers took her aside and said, "You're much too good to be a cruiser. You need to go back to school and be the pianist that's in you." And so she went back to school and she studied, was about to receive a master's degree, was rehearsing for her last concert. And as she rode her bike out of the parking lot, a truck pulled into the parking lot and smashed into her. She was unconscious for a week. And when she awoke, she had all of the signs of schizophrenia, which she's now had for her whole life. She can still play the piano. I run into her every once in a while. She knows I'm jealous of her ability to play the piano, and she laughs at me good-humoredly. But she also hallucinates and is delusional. And it's an example of what we call the two-hit hypothesis. She got hit once before birth when her brain was being formed because she carried some of the genetic predisposition for schizophrenia. And then she got hit a second time from her brain injury.
So a trigger that brings up a latent leaning towards schizophrenia can occur.
Exactly. So we don't think people can be 100% protected,
and
we can start things off.
I imagine that also would not just be traumatic brain injury, but that could be life events, a serious loss or a tragedy, some series of experiences that bring to the surface something which had not yet surfaced.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And we see the onset the manifestation of schizophrenia normally in early adulthood, people in their 20s, maybe in their early 30s, without triggers, is that something that you believe, Dr. Friedman, occurs in utero?
I think that the first roots are in utero, because that's when the genes are active, and there are also things that can impact how a baby's developing in the mother's environment, things like infection, malnutrition, and drug use. So any of those added to the genetic predisposition in utero set the baby up for a lifetime which is going to be mentally difficult. And then the last impetus to mental illness can be a piece of brain trauma, or, as you pointed out, perhaps separation from the family, off to college or off to the army. Those are the kinds of things, or childbirth, that will set off the last tip into mental illness.
So if choline is essential to brain development in a fetus, and if choline is deficient in pregnant women because they're deficient, is the simple solution to give choline to pregnant women?
That's what we thought. And so that's what we've been doing. Because women, the only time in the human life cycle when people are deficient in choline is when they're trying to make another human being. So because it takes an enormous amount of choline to form all the cells of the placenta and the baby. And when a mother attempts to do that, she needs to eat a tremendous amount of choline. And unfortunately, most women don't do that. And in addition, if the woman is stressed, she will hold the choline in her liver instead of giving it to the baby. That's part of the stress response.
So you really can't get enough through diet. I know you get choline through eggs and seafood and liver, but are you saying most pregnant women just can't eat enough of that to get enough choline?
That's correct. I once gave the talk in Italy, and I explained that if the woman was willing to eat a full serving of calf's liver a day, she would likely get enough choline. And I said, but most women won't eat calf's liver every day, particularly if they're pregnant. And the women in their audience threw up their hands and they said, of course, American women can't cook. Our daughters in Italy, they'll eat liver.
It can be yummy if properly prepared and with enough onions.
At least in Tuscany, I'm told that's true.
Yes. So then is this as simple as getting the word out to women that they should take choline? And if so, has that happened? Are women taking choline in pregnancy?
Well, first of all, I'm grateful to your show. If we can reach a few more women or a lot more women, I would be very grateful. It's slow going.
Why? Why is that?
And people are conservative about pregnancy. Anything new always carries a risk, even though this is a natural ingredient. There's always unknowns. And so most obstetricians are busy. They're not particularly concerned about what mental health is going to be like in 20 years. And so it's been slow in uptake. I should say at the University of Colorado, every woman gets advised to take choline, both in the family medicine practice and in the obstetrical practice. It's also true at the University of Illinois. And it's just something that takes a while. It was exactly the same way with folic acid. It took over a decade after the initial studies of folic acid before it became a universal recommendation. And even today, only 80% of women in America take folic acid.
You know, it's interesting. The problem you're describing makes perfect sense because people are very conservative. They want to follow, of course, the first Hippocratic rule of first do no harm. It's a rule for physicians, but it should be a rule for everyone. And so there is a tremendous conservatism about trying something new. And so let's spend a few minutes trying to explain to everyone why this is the correct thing to do if there's any doubt in anyone's mind. You did experiments, and you did them with experiments as to dosing, and you then followed children who had been fetuses. You followed them for some time. Talk about those experiences.
Sure. So what we did was to, first of all, of course, apply for permission for the Food and Drug Administration to carry on human experimentation. And the Food and Drug Administration granted us that permission. And they're the ones who yearly survey what we've done to make sure that, in fact, we're not causing harm to women. Also, the National Institute of Mental Health approved the study, and our own local review board at the University of Colorado. So we're a very highly regulated medical research group. We took 100 women and divided them into half randomly. The women didn't know what group they were in. None of the people who interacted with the women knew what group they were in. All the women got dietary instruction to eat as much food with choline as possible. So they were told about liver, and they were told about eggs, and they were told about meat and soybeans. Those are things that are high in choline. But in addition, half of them got corn oil capsules, a placebo, and half of them got capsules that contain phosphatidylcholine, the form of choline that's normally in food. And they were instructed to take these every day. And our nurses monitored them taking the medication and at the same time monitored their diet. The week that we ended the study, the head nurse came in to me crying. And I said, "What's wrong, Julie?" She said, "Dr. Friedman, I don't know how to tell you this, but I wrecked your experiment." And I said, "Well, what did you do?" She said, "I made sure that every woman ate as much choline food as possible. And you won't see any difference between those who took the supplement and those who got the placebo." Now, remember, Julie doesn't know who got the supplement and who got the placebo.
Right.
She was just telling all the women to eat as much choline as possible.
It's double blind in the sense that Julie doesn't know who's getting the placebo and who's getting the phosphatidylcholine, and neither does the patient.
That's right. And neither do I at this point.
Right.
So I said, "Julie, don't worry about it. You did what I wanted you to do. We don't want babies who are choline deficient. We want everyone, every baby to get a full shot at life. Remember, the baby has only one chance to develop its brain. And we don't want to do anything to interfere with that natural process, even though we're studying ways to improve it." She said, "No, I'm sure I wrecked the experiment."
Because
so the next
she
week,
thought she had given so much choline-laden food to the placebo group that that would all turn out the same.
That's right. So we had a group of babies who Julie had not encouraged, because when we first started our research, we just looked at babies as they were. We had Julie's encouraged babies on placebo and Julie's encouraged babies who had also gotten a choline supplement. And they ranked 1, 2, 3. The Julie's babies who had placebo that she'd encouraged did do a bit better than just babies who we studied at random. But the babies who had received the supplement have done much better. They did not better not only immediately after birth, they did better a year later, and 4 years later, they were still much better able to pay attention than the other babies, and much more social, much less likely to have sleep problems. They were, in all aspects, much better children at 4 years old than the ones who had not received the choline supplement.
I should point out that the experiments that you're discussing, Dr. Friedman, took place starting in, I believe it was 2013.
That's right.
And here we are in 2022. So presumably, if we figure a 9-month pregnancy, these babies are now probably about 10 years old.
Right.
What are we finding today?
They're continuing to do well. Unfortunately, babies drift and mothers drift, and so we don't know where all these children are anymore. And many of them have moved away from Denver, or we've lost them to contact. So 4 years old is about as long as we can practically track a child.
Is that because it's expensive to keep track of people?
It's expensive, and also people just move and leave no forwarding address, essentially. We're dealing with women who are in safety net hospitals, and one of the tragedies these women face is that about for over half of them, the address they enter the hospital with is not the address they leave the hospital with. So often they go back to their families of origin, and the grandmothers end up raising the children.
So, these are difficult times. You referred to safety net hospitals. What's a safety net hospital?
Safety net hospital is one that accepts women on Medicaid, where women don't have to have a private physician. So these mothers are very dedicated mothers. They come in early in their pregnancy to get their care, but they don't have all of the resources behind them in terms of having other things in their life stable. In many cases, their child is the most stable thing in their life.
On your website, prenataldoctoradvice.com, you have a section called Black Babies Matter. And
yes,
you say, many black babies in the United States are born prematurely. Prematurity is related to black women's stress from racism and social injustice. Premature babies often have more problems playing with other children, poorer attention in school, and more mental illnesses. Stress lowers women's levels of choline, a natural nutrient found in eggs, meat, and soybeans. And you go on to explain that linking choline as a nutrient prenatally can make a tremendous difference in the lives of black babies. Have you done these experiments in the 100 women in Denver that you worked with? Did you do this with people exclusively in safety net hospitals and Medicaid environments, or did you do this across all social and racial strata?
So our initial study of 100 women was done in safety net patients. We then did a second study with another 160 women where we simply observed their choline. And we're now doing a third study with 150 women, half of whom got placebo and half of whom got choline. In our latest study, a third of the women are people who actually work in the hospital. So they're not safety net people. They're nurses, midwives, and we have about 10 physicians who are in the study. These women saw the study going on, got excited about it, and wanted to be in the study. So to me, it's very much a compliment to our nurses that people see them in operation and want them to be part of their care and are willing to be in a study. So it's we're now getting a full range of women.
And so this always is the issue with that I think lay people frequently have with science. The science is something that is done with rigor and structure and rules, and they're followed. And so to actually figure something out for the benefit, for the public benefit and for generations, you have to have a control group who's getting a placebo. And I would imagine it'd be hard to talk a lot of people. I would think a lot of people would be hard to convince that they should do an experiment of not getting maybe the choline and instead getting the placebo for their own pregnancy, for their own child. Is that a challenge?
It is a challenge. And I have to say that I personally at first was against doing the third study for that reason. And so
because
we
were so convinced that the choline was so critically necessary, you didn't want to deprive the control group of it.
Exactly.
Same as Julie, by the way, who came in at
yours. Julie and I think very much along the same lines. I think that's why we got along so well. So we had a conversation that was led by Marilyn Coors. You may recognize the name if you're from Colorado. The Coors family, of course, is our famous brewers. But as Marilyn says, I do the ethics. My husband makes the beer. And she's a very prominent medical ethicist, and she convened a conference for us. And at the end of the conference, we decided it was the right thing to do the study, because really more evidence was needed. And what we needed to make sure, and we continue to make sure, is that every woman gets the same standard of care, regardless of how she's in the study. Now, what challenged that was COVID, because in the middle of our study of 150 women, COVID descended upon us. And we now had women who had the symptoms of COVID. And we knew that choline in high amounts had the chance of protecting their fetus against the kind of damage you see when a woman gets infected. So let me digress and tell you what happens when a woman gets infected when she's pregnant. And it doesn't have to be with COVID. It can be with flu or even a very severe respiratory infection with another one of the coronaviruses that are more associated with the common cold. You know that feeling about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when suddenly you feel awful, and you know from experience you're going to feel more awful as the afternoon goes on, and the next morning you're going to wake up feeling sick. Most of us, if we possibly can, run home at that point and get into bed and do our favorite remedy, from chicken soup to hot pads, whatever you think is going to help you.
Sure.
That's because your body has already detected the virus and is releasing a whole group of compounds called cytokines, which are the body's first line of defense against the foreign body.
Well, and let's pause for a second to point out also that when you are sick and you have these the fever, runny nose, watery eyes, sneezing, coughing, fever. This is not the infection. This is not the disease. This is the power and the violence of your immune system releasing these cytokines, and short of a cytokine storm, are actually combating in a war in your body against the infection. Do I have that
right?
That's right.
You're correct. And in addition, how is the fetus and its placenta regarded? They're also regarded as foreigners. And so the mother's immune response to the virus is also attacking the placenta. And as a result, the placenta can't do quite what it's supposed to do, and the fetus ends up being deprived of nutrients and oxygen. And so at a critical time, it's like there's a little strangulation on the spinal, on the umbilical cord, strangling the fetus while the mother's trying to fight off the infection.
Sure, because what the mother's body is doing is saying the life of the mother outweighs the life of the fetus, and if somebody's going to die, it's going to be the fetus, not the mother. And so the body is triaging and saying,
right,
we need to save the mother, and if that costs some health or even the life of the fetus, then that is what we are going to do, because then the mother may, from a biological point of view, the mother may live to form another fetus.
All of that is correct. And one of the things we know over the long run is that the fetus is now has double the risk of ADHD, autism, or schizophrenia.
Because of oxygen deprivation?
During this period of infection, particularly when the infection occurs early in pregnancy while the brain is being formed.
Wow.
So now we have our study going on with some women getting placebo and some women getting
choline
supplements. And all of the women being exposed to COVID because of the pandemic, and some of them getting symptoms of COVID, and some of them testing positive for COVID. So what were we to do? Ethically, we decided we needed to vary what we were doing a bit. And what we did was, for every woman who was in the study whom we suspected of having COVID because of a positive test or because of symptoms, we gave her extra choline on a non-blind basis. So she, if she was willing to stay in the study, and all of the women, including the physicians in the study, thought that was a good idea. And so they stayed in the study. They might be taking placebo. They might be taking choline. If they were taking choline, they now had a double dose. If they were taking placebo, they now had at least one full dose. And we continued them that way until they delivered. So because the children are now only about 1 year old, we don't know who got what. But we do know that we've done everything possible we can to protect all of the women in our study, including those on placebo.
You know, I can so see this argument both ways, Dr. Friedman, that you have on the one hand these individual human beings right here in front of you who need protection and who need health, and you have the larger good of society, which if we abandoned scientific principles in the past, we wouldn't have penicillin, we wouldn't have antibiotics, we wouldn't have all of the miracle machines from CT scans to ultrasound to anything else. We wouldn't have all of the unbelievable drugs and medications that we have, from anticoagulants to statin drugs or anything else, if we had abandoned those. So it's a tough, tough moral, ethical question.
That's right. But we do have one thing, and that is we measured the choline levels in these women. Now, again, we're still blind, so we don't know what those levels mean at the moment. But we will know what every woman's choline level was during the time her baby was developing its brain.
When will you know?
We know it now, but once the babies reach 4 years old, we'll look at that data and measure it against how the babies are performing at 4 years of age.
Yeah, when you say we know it now, you mean we have the data now, but
yes,
we're blind.
We went ahead and assayed those, and so we have a table of all the choline levels.
We just don't know who's who.
Right.
So which, at the age of four, we'll know. So about 3 years from now.
That's right.
Well, you're going to be back on the show in 2025.
I hope so.
So do you factor in whether a pregnant mother has mental illness as a
yes.
variable? How do you control for that?
Well, we don't. We take all comers. Originally, the FDA for our original study wanted us to take healthy women only. And for this study, they came back and said, no, now we want you to take women who are sick, women who are not sick, a much wider range of women. We excluded women who abused drugs the first time around. This time we did not. Again, at the FDA's proper guidance that we look at a much wider range of women. And so we measure their drug use. About 30% of women now use marijuana during their pregnancy, mostly to control morning sickness. None of us recommend that, but morning sickness is quite painful and disturbing. And it's part of the culture now that marijuana is one of the remedies people try if they've been marijuana smokers in the past. We haven't had any mothers who've taken up marijuana for morning sickness, but we have had mothers who continue their use of marijuana, particularly the younger women.
You raised a question I've never even thought of. Has marijuana been shown to be teratogenic? That is, genetic effects and generate different genetic outcomes?
It doesn't generate different genetic outcomes, but babies whose mothers have received marijuana generally are less able to pay attention as children. That's really the most sensitive thing we look at, this ability to focus attention. Essentially, what we're trying to do is prevent the early signs of ADHD, which are also the early signs of schizophrenia and autism.
All of those seem to be tied, and I know that over the last decade, there's been a tremendous change in how the spectrum has been viewed. And it seems like all of these things are tied together, from from attention deficit disorder all the way to schizophrenia. Is that now viewed as one continuum of as a continuing strand of one thing?
Pretty much so. I and many of my colleagues worked very diligently to separate these illnesses based on diagnostic criteria. When we were doing the initial genetic studies of all these illnesses, and when the data came in, we realized we were looking at overlapping sets of genes anyway. So we can rigorously try to separate someone with ADHD only from someone with schizophrenia, and they'll both have deficits in the nicotinic receptor that we study. The same is true for forms of bipolar illness and autism as well.
They all have
common genetic roots.
All of us who are parents, or for that matter, grandparents, want the best for our children or our grandchildren. Aside from the protections that are offered by choline, is there a reason to believe that children might otherwise be improved, perhaps have an advantage over their peers who do not receive prenatal choline, aside from avoiding the spectrum of mental illness?
We're not going to produce super children. What we produce are children who are in the upper half of normal. And if you can avoid being in the lower half of normal, your life's going to be much better if you're in the upper half of normal. But we're not making children who exceed the normal level in any sense. All we're doing is, like most things in medicine, is trying to make sure that people are as close to normal as possible.
I am obviously not going to get pregnant, but is there any percentage in non-pregnant people taking choline?
No, it's very much like folic acid. People have looked for things that choline does after birth, but even when the child is just a couple of weeks old, we found that extra choline was not helpful anymore. All of this occurs before birth, just like folic acid works on spinal cord generation before birth. After birth, if someone has spina bifida or cleft palate, the kinds of things that folic acid protects from, you can give folic acid all day long and that palate and that spinal cord won't close. You need to do surgery at that point. And the same thing is true with choline. The ball game's over by the time the baby's born.
So, and I've always believed that from a developmental point of view, that the ball game's over by the time a child is about 4, maybe as late as 5 years old, in terms of instilling the structure for future behavior, and in terms of external parental guidance and experiential quality, that you can make changes on the margins after a child is 4 or 5 years old, but most of what you've given them has been given to them by that age, good or bad. You're saying now, if I understand it, but that on the day of the child's birth, that the overwhelming future has already been determined from a genetic point of view, but moreover, from perhaps this prenatal nutrition point of view.
I think that's true. I'm all for good parenting, and I think it helps. But also the babies, it takes two to do good parenting, not only the intentions of the parents, but the baby's ability to receive it. And that's largely determined by the baby's brain health. And in turn, that's largely determined by how the baby develops its brain. And it's a combination of genetics, luck, hopefully your mother didn't get COVID, and also nutrition. So of those things, we can't change the genetics. We can't change whether or not a mother is going to be infected, although certainly vaccines are helpful and we recommend them strongly. But we can change what the nutrition is. So it's the one thing we can do is to make sure that the baby has an adequate array of nutrients, choline, folic acid, vitamin D, vitamin A. And that's what we're all about.
You wrote an article just about a year ago with three colleagues. It was published in World Psychiatry. And it says the prenatal period is the first developmental step towards psychosis. And you point out three pillars of evidence that are risk factors. One is maternal adversity. So that would be prenatal starvation or prenatal infection, the things you and I have been discussing. And two, molecular evidence that a substantial group of genes associated with psychosis is expressed more robustly in the fetal brain before birth than in the brain after birth. So it will show up before birth and not be as easily detected after birth. And the third pillar being postmortem findings from psychotic patients show that the maturation of certain brain receptors while they were fetuses in those patients were incomplete, and that this is irreversible over the patient's lifespan. And that leads to a brain that processes information more slowly and less efficiently and is consistent with schizophrenic patients' lifelong deficits, and it's very hard to fix after birth. This ties together with what you were just saying, so it makes... We've known for decades that prenatal care is essential. The statistics show that pregnant women were still smoking a lot of cigarettes, drinking plenty of alcohol, still into the 50s and early 60s, but that people who were born after mostly the mid-60s had fewer problems with fetal alcohol syndrome, fewer problems secondary to nicotine poisoning, all of those things improved. And so we've known for decades that prenatal care is important. But what you're saying is that this specific addition of choline will make a marked difference in what levels of mental illness we will see in the future. Is that all?
That's correct. I should mention a group of, we're not the only group that studies choline. And there are three other groups that have done clinical trials. One of those groups went to South Africa, and specifically because there is a group of women there who believe strongly that smoking, marijuana, and alcohol are something that you do freely during pregnancy. So these are women who, because of their culture, purposely are taking large amounts of choline, marijuana, and alcohol during their pregnancy. And these women consented to a trial of choline in approximately the same doses that we've tried here in the United States. And the group is called the Cape Town Colored. Colored is not a word we use in the United States anymore, but it's still used in South Africa. And it refers to a group of mixed Indonesians, Bantus, and Dutch women that historically have lived in a certain section of Cape Town. These women, babies, were much better able to pay attention if the mother received choline while she was pregnant. So choline is really something that is emerging that fights against all of these possible ways that fetal development can go wrong.
What are you trying to do as a scientist, as a physician? What are you going about doing?
So our first mission is to do this third and, for me, final research project. I'm 76 years old, so the babies grow up. The babies take 9 months. We can't rush that. They take 4 years to grow up. And my clock runs at the same speed as their clock, but my clock is running towards the end. So this will be the last study that I will do. And it's important to me that it be done as well as possible. And so some of your colleagues in the law have stepped up to try to make sure that we have the funds to continue this study, particularly John and Kathy Woodward, your partners. In addition, though, I also view myself as an advocate for choline. And so we are working very hard with the Colorado legislature right now to see if we can obtain, at least in the state of Colorado, as a model study, that all women have access to choline. Now, any woman can buy any number of choline products, choline or phosphatidylcholine. Either one works fine. There are advantages and disadvantages to each preparation. They're all available on Amazon. Many of them are available in local health food stores and groceries because they're often taken as health foods. They're all freely available. You don't need a doctor's prescription. But the minimum cost is about $200 a pregnancy for the very cheapest form of choline, which is a perfectly adequate form. And so what we're trying to do is advocate that women, first of all, be aware of this possibility, that obstetricians and family medicine doctors be aware of this possibility. And second, that women who decide they want to take it will either be able to buy it, or if they can't afford it, if they're on Medicaid, that Medicaid will pay for it. At the moment, Medicaid offers different prenatal vitamins. None of them contain sufficient amounts of choline. And so we're trying to change that. And the legislature is stepping forward to helping us do that. So in brief, we want to make sure that we have the research basis covered as tightly as possible, but also make sure that we have access for women who want it.
For someone who's going to a nutrition store to buy choline or phosphatidylcholine, it's clear to me from your writings that dosage, it needs to be the Goldilocks. It has to be right in the right spot. You don't want to overdose on this. What's the right dosage? How do you determine that?
We recommend approximately 1,000 milligrams. The FDA's recommended daily amount for pregnant women is 550 milligrams. That recommendation was made over 7 years ago and hasn't been revised yet. All of the research studies, not only ours, but the other three, have used approximately twice that dose, and that seems to be about right. Altogether, over 300 women have been treated that way, and an additional 75 in our studies. No woman has had an adverse effect, and no fetus has had an adverse effect. So we believe that's a safe and effective dose.
Is this at all controversial? Am I correct that phosphatidylcholine is a form or derivative of vitamin B, that this is harmless in proper doses? Or is this controversial? Are there people who oppose this?
No, there's really no opposition. It's being widely recommended, and it's just really a matter of making people aware of it and making sure that it's part of their regimen.
I always hate...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. You had another thought.
Sure. When folic acid, when the first evidence for folic acid became apparent, the British were the first to recognize that many women would be slow on the uptake. And particularly one problem is that many women don't plan their pregnancies. Pregnancies happen for other reasons. And so they're not taking folic acid preconception. And so as a result, there was an enormous push, first in Britain and then in the United States, to put folic acid in as many foods as possible. So all of us essentially, without our consent, although with our knowledge, if we read the labels, are taking large doses of extra folic acid simply to protect the pregnant women who don't know they're pregnant yet, their fetuses. So uptake is difficult because women are often slow to take prenatal vitamins until they're convinced they're pregnant and that they want the baby. And that can take several months, but the baby has already started developing its brain. We don't have a way right now of supplementing choline in food. And so women essentially have to be aware that this is something they need to do as soon as possible. And we're just trying to increase that awareness and also increase the availability.
What I was going to say is I hate asking scientists to guess because I know you don't like guessing, but guess for me. What percentage of the obstetricians and gynecologists across the country know about choline and are recommending it to their patients?
I would say it's probably at most 10%.
Okay. So that brings me to the question of how do you get the word out? And why is it hard to get good information like this? And when I say good information, from everything I've been able to understand, not just today, but in the reading I did prior to today, this is harmless unless you overdose. But then again, you could overdose on anything. So that's not the issue. If it's properly dosed, this is harmless. And where there's no harm, and it even might do some good, and I think you've gone well beyond showing that it might do some good. It certainly does some good and does great good. Why is it so hard to get the word out to the medical community?
It's a conservatism. Also, people are busy. And so obstetricians, their goal is to get a baby out that's healthy enough to go into the mother's arms. And that's a big job. I don't think any of us take it for granted, the enormous improvement in obstetrical practice. Babies are born today much healthier than they were born even two decades ago. But that requires a lot of attention to a lot of different details. And this is simply one that often gets shoved to the back. And I think the other problem is there's a lot of noise about nutrition. There's a lot of people recommending a lot of different things, sometimes with evidence, but often with no evidence. And so it's a very noisy environment, and unless someone is studying it, it's very difficult to determine what should be the best practice. That saying, I'm going to fault the obstetricians just a little bit. Their guidelines don't even keep up with the 2016 FDA guidelines. So they are looking at guidelines that are over 25 years old. And one of the initiatives we have right now is Camille Hoffman, the obstetrician on our project, has gotten herself on the Fetal Nutrition Committee of the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians to make sure that we bring them up to date.
So I'm going to give some advice to people, to women who are pregnant, and then after you hear it, tell me if I get anything wrong, and then add anything you'd like. I'm going to start by quoting Catherine Monk, an associate professor of psychiatry and obstetrics and gynecology at the Columbia University Medical Center, is quoted in one of the articles that you sent me. She said that a mother's emotional state has a clear impact on a developing fetus. She and others have shown that stress, depression, and anxiety during pregnancy increase a child's risk for ADHD, conduct disorders, and depression later in life. At Columbia, Dr. Monk and her colleagues employ a program, Practical Resources for Effective Postpartum Parenting, or PREP, P-R-E-P-P, in which pregnant women who are distressed and at high risk for postpartum depression are counseled and taught coping skills to make pregnancy and parenting more manageable emotionally. And you would recommend optimal nutrition, say fewer donuts, more broccoli and spinach, folic acid, of course choline and zinc and omega-2 fatty acids, and of course not smoking, and of course not drinking alcohol, and of course not taking items with tetrahydrocannabinol, in other words, marijuana or pot. What would you add to that, and did I put anything in there I shouldn't have?
No, I think those are all good recommendations, but I should say that women who end up discovering that they've been smoking nicotine or marijuana or using alcohol shouldn't give up. Good nutrition, folic acid, choline, vitamins are going to overcome some of those effects. It's not permission to continue using them, but it is saying that there are positive things you can do for your fetus as well. It's always a balance of positives and negatives. What we're doing is trying to accentuate the positives while making clear we know what the negatives are. Many people did not want to publish our research showing that choline could reverse some of the effects of marijuana because they thought we would be encouraging women to use marijuana. We never encourage women to use marijuana, but they do. And if they do, it's all the more reason to make sure that that baby receives adequate nutrition as well.
Dr. Robert Friedman, I want to say thank you so much for joining me here today on TalkRadio1.com. I have learned a lot from speaking with you just now, and I do hope that you'll come back with me on the air when you have further results from the latest round of studies and from the next one that you're doing.
I would be delighted to.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Dr. Robert Friedman. Take a look at his website, prenataldoctoradvice.com, prenataldoctoradvice.com. And it was with all good works, Dr. Friedman would appreciate donations if you'd be willing to make them. I think his work is saving lives and enhancing our world. He is one of the good guys. That's prenataldoctoradvice.com. Dr. Robert Friedman. My thanks to John and Kathy Woodward, two of our dearest and closest friends, and of course John, my law and business partner of almost 45 years. It was John and Kathy who suggested that I speak with Dr. Friedman today, and I'm grateful for that. My next show will be 2 weeks from today. That is Saturday, August the 6th, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please use our Amazon, PayPal, and eBay links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. My email address, steve@TalkRadio1.com, steve@TalkRadioone.com. And I spell it because although you can get to the website with the number one or O-N-E, the only way we get email, and I've had a couple of people mention this to me, the only way we get email is if you send it to steve@TalkRadioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.